Okie dokie, we're back on.
Okay, so yeah, the pulses, where were we at? So, you know, in the past they'd have what they call windows of opportunity for the fish to move upriver, but, you know, they'd have a closure for a few days in the lower river, but a lot of times, you know, they didn't follow the fish upriver. That group of fish that were restricted in the lower river really wouldn't be, you know, by the time the fish moved up to the next district, they'd have a closure there too. But the timing really wasn't, they didn't worry about the timing too much. But lately, they're getting into what they call pulse closures, where they try to follow the fish upriver and make sure that nobody gets to fish on the first pulse or the second pulse or however they're going to do it. So that's what I mean by pulse closures.
Okay, now, let's get into...
In 2009, yeah, that's I think what we were... Yeah. In 2009, they had, for the first time ever, they had pulse closures, and it was considerable. It actually was, up in this area, it was a good bit of... it was basically almost, you know, all of pulse one and part of pulse two. And then on top of that, they had just the fishing prior to and after that was half-time restrictions. So, I mean, those fish that year that came up in 2009 were pretty much unmolested, you know, and we were able to, prior to that season, I was told that I knew this was maybe going to happen, and a suggestion was made to me that I should maybe get a permit and try to collect data on those fish, because normally I just collect our data on subsistence fish. Subsistence fisherman catches the fish, he does what he wants with them. He cuts them, he allows me to measure them. You know, I don't need a permit to do that. But for me to, during a closure, go up to my fish wheel and maybe like net a fish and then weigh it and then release it back into the river, you know, that's messing with fish that aren't, those aren't subsistence fish. Those are the state's fish, you know. And so I have to get a permit to do that. So we did. We put in for a permit for 300 Chinook. And during the first pulse and second pulse closures and stuff, we sent the kids out to the wheel and we collected weights off of those fish. We didn't get a lot of information other than the weights. I mean, the weights was all we got. But that weight information was really valuable, because that had never happened before. Like in 2000, there had been some windows, you know. There had been some restricted fishing, and there wasn't any commercial fishing. And that year the amount of Chinook salmon that we caught was considerably more. It was almost twice as many as the next best year. I mean, there were a lot of fish that year. But in 2000, we weren't taking any kind of length or weight information either, so we don't know, you know, that. But in 2009, we went further. We, you know, closed. It was more closures. There was no commercial fishing, and there was just fish everywhere. I mean,
and substantially larger.
Oh, substantially larger. You get a. You're talking about the average weight for fish during the first pulse was 15.5 pounds. The average weight for the whole season was 14.4. That is, you know,
way over.
Yeah, that is way over. That's maybe, you know, I mean, it was really encouraging in a way, because it shows you that you can make a difference. Now, we got a long way to go, and it would be maybe good to do that for a bunch of generations consistently, but, you know, but here's how the pendulum swings, you know. 2009, we passed a few extra fish into Canada. And like people like me and said, well, that's good. You know, we need a few extra to make up for the fact that, you know, there's very few large fish, even still in that, you know, large amount of fish that passed and that larger size fish that passed, there was still a lack of the older age classes. And it probably wasn't as good a quality as, you know, in the old days at all, you know. So, I mean, those few extra fish that we passed, that's good. But the way the politics work, you know, is that, okay, well, there's no problem anymore with the king salmon. That was a good run, you know. And so next year, hopefully, we can go commercial fishing. Because that's how fast people forget, you know, about the problem. So come 2010 season, which we just had, you know, we tried at the Board of Fish meeting and stuff like that to get, like, pulse closures, you know, instituted, like, automatically and make it, like, by regulation. And all that got turned down and stuff like that. So 2010 season comes along, and we just start fishing normally. There wasn't a commercial because it was recognized early on that there was a problem with the numbers of fish again. But it wasn't like, they're still not looking at the female rates and the size of the fish. They're just looking at numbers. And so we ended up having probably the worst size year. And I had my worst number year since 2000. We had under 1,000 fish caught in the fish wheel, which is the lowest we've ever had since the project started in 2000. And, you know, like I say, 10.8-pound average, just terrible quality that we put in. And now, you know, it's the pendulum's going to swing. This year, they're already talking about having all sorts of meetings this coming winter about what to do about next year, and that next year we'll probably need to have some pulse closures and stuff. So maybe next year we'll have some pulse closures and we'll pass a 13-point-something-pound average, and there'll be a few more fish, and then everybody will go, okay, well, maybe we can go back to commercial fishing in 2012, you know. It's just like, you know, we're just so far away from actually doing anything about this problem.
It doesn't, you know, sound like there is... you know, serious biologists in place for a career to regulate these things in a steady way. It sounds like it's just jumping back and forth.
It's jumping back and forth, and every year we continue to, the trend is still to hurt the king salmon more than we hurt it. Not, you know, perfectly, like, trending, but it's we're hurting the fish. Like, in 2010, we hurt the fish more than we've probably ever hurt it before. We've probably never done that much damage to a run before. 2009, because of the pulse closures, might have been like we helped it a little. But 2007, 2008, I can't imagine. I think when we get the return from 2008, and I've been predicting this, is I think when we get the return from 2008, we're not even going to be able to have subsistence fishing in the Yukon River. I don't see how when you pass like during the first pulse, I think we average weight for fish during the first pulse, the entire first pulse, was under 10 pounds, and it was something like a 7-pound female. It was a 7% female rate. So how are you going to get any kind of a return back on Canadian fish? Because that first pulse is, you know, the one that's heavy on the Canadian fish. How are you going to get any fish back into Canada on a year like that? You know, when the return year, 5 years, 6 years later. So we continue, and what happens is, sure, everybody will say, you'll go to a meeting and everybody will say, we're just being restricted more and more and more, you know, but they don't realize that each year, because the run is continuing to decline, that those restrictions are needed more and more, but the restrictions have never kept up with the need. See, that's the thing. That's the thing that fishermen and everybody is missing, is that had we 20 years ago cut down the 100,000 fish commercial that we were having that year, and if we had cut that down to, say, 80,000, I'm just making these numbers up. I mean, leave it to the experts to, come up with some better numbers here. But our commercials were, running 80 to 120,000 back then. And then we had full subsistence and we had full passage into Canada, most years, So there was a pretty good sized run coming in the mouth of the Yukon, every year. And 5 and 6 years later, after having this 100,000 commercial and big subsistence take, a good amount of king salmon would come back and we'd be able to have another commercial. I mean, we were maintaining things, However, that we were probably taking a little bit too much. And then enter things like ichthyophonous disease, which probably changed the whole equation. But had we back in those years just taken 80,000, and this was the suggestion back in those years that we do that, that we're probably taking a little bit too much commercial. There were reports back, and this might be another one that I could get for you. There was a report back in, this thing is back in the, 60s, 50s. It was a report. Virgil Umphenhauer is big on this one, on this report. But anyway, this report, we brought it before the Board of Fish this last this last time, to point out that, that people talked, that biologists talked about our inability to maintain this kind of commercial take. Way back when that they thought that large mesh gill nets, selective gear and large takes like this was not a maintainable thing in the Yukon River for such and such a reason. Anyway, there are people that were saying, we're probably taking a little bit too much king salmon. We need to, lop off a little. Well, back then you had the entire commercial fishing industry and ADF&G going along with them saying, we can't do that. People will starve. People will not make enough money. People, that's too drastic. Well, put that in the perspective of 2010, or even in the last 10 years, put that in perspective of, back in 2000. Just think what a commercial fishery right now of 80,000 plus a full subsistence, and had that worked, had that not taking the full 100,000 and only taking 80, had that made a difference, had that extra 20,000 fish being put on the spawning grounds made the difference, which 20,000 is a lot of fish extra to put on a spawning ground, Had that made a difference, and we now had a decent run, and we're able to catch 80,000 commercial, that would look nowadays like incredible. Because what have we had lately? We've had no commercial. We've had extremely restricted subsistence. And even with all that, the runs are declining to the point, have declined to the point where we, even though there is no commercial and there is extreme restrictions on subsistence, we still we are having trouble meeting basic escapement into Canada. Or right now, in 2010, this is a subject that's been neglected a lot because there's no international treaty agreement connected with it, but, you know, people have always, there's all this focus on the Canadian stocks because of the treaty thing, you know. Well, they're always saying, well, we should try to take more of the U.S. stocks and let more of the Canadian go. Well, this last year, we couldn't meet basic escapement on the Chena River. And the Chena and the Salcher, that's basically the whole king salmon run on the Tanana River. Those two streams, creeks, you know, that's where by far the bulk of the king salmon, you know, head to on the, and so if one of those you can't meet, and the other was just barely past basic escapement.
And there goes the Tanana.
And they're going into Canada. Those are U.S. stocks. So not only did we not meet escapement into Canada, but we didn't meet escapement on half of the Tanana River. And really, the other one, it can be argued that those escapement goals have been lowered way too much anyway. You know, that they're lower than they should be anyway. So.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So I want to get at the whole issue of when you're beginning to speak up at meetings and write your letters and then getting real data. I want to get at the reception you get from particularly Fish and Game, Fish and Wildlife Service people. Who out there was listening to you and doing something? Who were just not listening, not believing, not taking action?
Well, I was getting a lot of encouragement to take this data from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service people in Fairbanks, the Fairbanks Field Office. The people who worked at the rapids. I had, actually, to this day, I'm still getting a lot of support from them, although it's, you know, because I have gotten pretty controversial over the years, you know. You know, they can't actively support, you know, some of what I'm doing, but they do support the data collection. And back in those years, well, it was actually this guy, Tevis Underwood, who helped me start the student data collection project as a way to get kids more involved in fisheries work and stuff like that. And again, he was the one who showed me how to write grants and stuff like that, encouraged me to put in for the Chinook project, you know, and to use my, you know, fish wheel data as you know, start collecting the fish wheel data. So I got a lot of support from them, and I got a lot of support for people in ADF&G also, but a lot of their biologists and stuff like that, you know, there was a lot of good support there too. But where it ends is where the biology and the management separates. And, you know, in both these places, both Fish and Wildlife Service and ADF&G, it's kind of like working for a corporation or the military, you know. I've kind of seen this attitude like in BLM before, you know, where, you know, like, When you work for these outfits, you're really limited in what you can say and what you can support. And even though I had like a lot of support from probably the majority of biologists and researchers in these organizations, you know, when it came to the management, there was a lot of we had a lot of difficulties because of the data I was putting out. They you know, and more so with ADF&G probably.
Can you say, made a little question, you said you became controversial, and so I think that's what you're alluding to now, is that some of the data you were putting out, take us through that. What were you putting out? Why was that controversial?
Well, the there was, like I say, there's two main categories of data, and one would be the disease, the ichthyophonous disease data that we were collecting, the rate of disease, the that was in the king salmon going by, and then there was the size data, you know, length, size and sex data, you know, the quality of the run data, I guess you'd maybe call all that, the size, sex, and you know, all that sort of stuff. So there was those two areas, and on the ichthyophonous data, the problem with ichthyophonous is that if ichthyophonous could be shown to be there in a great enough amount, and if ichthyophonous could be shown that it was actually killing fish before they got to be able to spawn properly, that amount of fish should probably be added to the amount that we had to pass into Canada. That was the that's the political, biological, you know, that's where politics and biology, they got to be a problem, because commercial fishery interests did not want to give up any fish. They don't want to have to, instead of passing 100,000 fish that, you know, now it'd be 130,000 fish or 150,000 fish, you know, whatever that number would be. They don't want to have to let more fish go by to make up for the ones that are going to die. And so the stuff that we were doing, we weren't showing any kind of data that was showing that fish were going to die before they got there, but we were taking disease rate information, and some of that information was showing that female rates, the rates for disease in females was as high as 50%. And of course, there's been enough studies in the past on ichthyophonous that there's enough data out there that's showing that, or that's telling everybody that ichthyophonous usually kills fish. You know, but it hadn't been really proven in the Yukon. But there were people like Dick Kosan that were doing active around 2000, you know, in those years prior to and a little after, you know, were doing studies on the Yukon, getting funding from the Yukon River Panel and stuff like that, and Office of Federal Subsistence Office, you know, and he was doing studies, and he was finding that the few places that he did study, he found that there was less fish infected with ichthyophonous on the spawning grounds in these few places. So, you know, that would lead you towards thinking that, you know, those fish weren't making it there. And that's all we have, because right after that, pretty much from ways that you'd probably best have explained to you by Dick Kosan, he was basically blackballed from the Yukon. And his research, I know one thing I remember back in those days, there was such a outcry from management, from state management, over his reports and his information that was, that he was, his findings, that the technical reviews of his report he wouldn't change the report. There were these technical reviews where they complained about like his reports not being the way they wanted them to read. And he was actually not even paid for one of his major studies, his last major studies that he did. And like I say, you could talk to him about this, but these technical review committees are, you know, heavily made up out of, you know, management, state management, you know, and stuff. And in the end, he actually had a lot of these studies. Years later, he actually had a lot of these studies, peer-reviewed and then had them published. And he's gone on to publish many, 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 many more articles on ichthyophonus and stuff like that. But so now looking at that denial of,
so stuff that Fish and Game wouldn't accept were later accepted by peer-reviewed journals.
Yeah, yeah. And right after that, the state actually did their own $500,000 ichthyophonus study. And there have been a number of reviews on that, peer reviews on that, and they're actually on my website. And one by Kosan himself, another by a Canadian biologist, and they're highly critical of their conclusions that ichthyophonus is not hurting the fish. And
so those are on your website.
Yeah, those are on my website, and so isn't their 2004 ichthyophonus or 2005 ichthyophonus report. And they never finished there was never a 2006 one because
so their study was 05.
This was 05. There should have been an 06 too, but that hasn't come out yet.
And
it's probably never going to come out.
The 05 was criticized by. Did they try to publish it at peer review?
They have tried a number of times to publish it. Now, I don't know that for a fact, but I know that through, you know, word of mouth that they have tried to publish it. That might be something you...
Who would I ask?
You could maybe ask Bonnie Borber in Fairbanks. Bonnie, and it's B-O-R-B-A. And she's head of research in Fairbanks. Or one of the research, you know, Yukon River research, or just
ADF&G.
Research at ADF&G, right on College there. Yeah, and you'll want to talk to her about a lot of this. She's one of the few people who has history, you know, on a lot of this sort of stuff, you know. And yeah, Bonnie's changed a lot over the years, but she's still, she still kind of toes the ADF&G line. She was probably one of the people who in the early years was highly critical of what I did. She was one of the people who were involved in a number of efforts to try to get my funding cut, and were actually able to get my funding cut. So I had to go to other sources to continue my projects.
Maybe we should digress a little and maybe tell that story.
And I have a paper on this too that I wrote, because when my funding was cut, I for a while kind of kept things a little quiet and didn't complain, and then I finally decided, well, if I'm going to go down the tube, I'm going to go down the tube pointing this out to everybody. So I wrote a pretty good long little letter and outlined all the comments that were made by the, you know, ADF, mostly by ADF&G management, but there was a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service manager in there too, and I outlined the comments, quote their quotes. A lot of them were publicly made, and I have the quotes and about how my project was inaccurate, how I. My numbers were, the project was basically obsolete. Bonnie Borber's quote had to do with the fact that I was herding fish when I was probably the most fish-friendly project on the river, and her department actually ran a number of Liebach, was still running Liebach projects on the river. And I have, you know, counters to that from biologists and stuff where they wrote letters in my favor pointing out that, you know, that some of the stuff wasn't true. And anyway, it was the end of my funding from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Federal Subsistence Office down in Anchorage. They were the ones who were funding me up until that point, and that was the end of that. So.
And has that ever been restored?
It's restored. The Canadians fund me now.
No, but I mean ADF&G.
No. No, that funding? No, but I don't need it anymore because I've been funded by the Yukon River panel ever since. You know, so, you know, the panel, see, is made up. Even though the panel is half made up out of U.S. managers and stuff, and a lot of the same people who got my funding cut, you know, make up the, you know, technical review committee of the panel, even though it's the same, a lot of the Canadians really like me because the Canadians, see, are in the same boat as the people in the upper river, only more so.
It's all your fault.
They've been experiencing, long before we experienced a decline in size and amount of fish and female rates, the Canadians noticed that. Like, I can think back of a Yerdfor meeting in Caltag where we had somebody from the First Nations and another kind of radical guy, from the Canada, and they came down to the Caltag meeting and they talked to us about little fish. And back in those days, it was like, oh, okay, you're getting little fish, huh? Oh, that's interesting, you know. And it was like, it didn't really hit home because we were still catching 50-pound fish. You know, and then that problem moved down to the U.S. side into the Eagle area and the Fort Yukon area, and then it started hitting us. And now that problem has, because as the runs get smaller and smaller and smaller, the problem just moves closer to the source. Because, you know, it's just the way, that's just the way things are. You know, it's like, you know, it's the end of the road after the fish have gone the gauntlet, you know,
Is it just that there's more set nets between the beginning and the end?
No, I think what it is I started seeing this thing where on years of where the runs were low, it was like more of a perception. I can't show it in the data, but I haven't really even tried. But I don't, when you get a low run, the fish that come in the mouth probably have about the same female rate and maybe the same size, you know, average size and all that, as a run that's a little bit bigger. But that run that's smaller, those people at the mouth, see, they don't notice any difference because it's the same. But as the fish move upriver, there's less fish that everybody's fishing on. So the 50 fish that each subsistence person takes out of that run is having more of an impact on the run in terms of taking out the bigger fish because everybody is fishing with large mesh gill nets, which select for, so yes, in that respect, what you're just saying, you know, it is because of it's not necessarily because of more nets. Well, it really isn't because there's probably less fishing. There is absolutely less fishing going on in the Yukon right now than there was 20 years ago, 30 years ago. But the runs are getting smaller. So those, and there's been a shift. Along with ichthyophonus and the size thing. Size thing is really an effect. ichthyophonus is something that, or ichthyophonus is a reason why the runs maybe have declined somewhat. But I think that another thing that is happening on this river that's had a negative effect is probably at least, if not more, than half the Chinook salmon on the river used to be taken with fish wheels. I remember in the old days having people say it was cheaper to build a fish wheel than it was to have a net. Now that was just one reason why people would have fish wheels. The other thing is if you have a all-season family fish camp, the wheel just keeps turning and keeps turning and keeps turning, and it, you know, and so you're not picking nets and you're not running multiple nets, so you could just row your boat over to the fish wheel. And but anyway, I remember there's data going back that shows like 150 fish wheels counted in between Fairbanks and Emonic, and that doesn't include the upper river. So I mean there was a tremendous amount of fish wheels, and these are not probably like nowadays in the fall time you see a lot of fish wheels going in the river to catch dog food. But nowadays there's sometimes only a half a dozen or 10 fish wheels in the entire Yukon River catching Chinook salmon, during Chinook salmon. I mean, this is, there have been years where I've had people come all the way down from Dawson and tell me that your fish wheels, these fish wheels in the rapids, are the first fish wheels they have seen in the river. And we've been halfway through King Salmon. So, depending on the year, like I bet like in 2010, this last year, I bet there might not have been, or 10 fish wheels would be the maximum. In some years in recent history, there's been less than that. So there's been this enormous shift from your full season family fish camps to people who now live in town and work or do whatever they, you know, and then during prime time fishing, during the 2 weeks of the, you know, the two prime weeks, three prime weeks of king salmon, they go out and they drift net a king salmon net or you know, set net or something like that. And so there's been this, the fish that are being taken, a higher percentage of the fish that are being taken with highly selective gear that's letting go all the small fish and just keeping the big fish.
Okay, so.
And that I think has exacerbated the problem.
Okay. But as far as the, I'm really interested in this idea that the Canadians noticed it first.
Oh, yeah.
Then they're seeing the Eagle, then Fort Yukon, then you guys, and we're still waiting for the lower river people to get it.
However, you can talk to any, there's people in the lower river now that are recognizing this problem. Now, here's a little piece of, you know, I don't know if this is the right time for it or not, but here's a little, I guess maybe anecdotal. In just prior to the 2007 Board of Fish meeting, the Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association, you know, YRDFR, had a vote. I happened to be chairman of the, I don't know how I ever got made chairman of the Fish Size Committee for YRDFR, but I think it has to do with the fact that I'm, even though I'm recognized as, I'm hated by some lower river people, even on the YRDFR board, for, you know, being speaking up about this problem, I am recognized as somebody who, when I'm put in that position, won't try to bias the situation too much. Anyway, I'm chairman of the Fish Size Committee, and I have insisted that the board vote on whether the board even recognizes that there is a problem on the Yukon River worth addressing, because we made this fish size committee, and then it was very controversial. Some of the stuff we were talking about, and I would bring up this thing like where, okay, before we can really even discuss this problem, we need to find out whether there's consensus on the board that there is a problem on the Yukon River that needs to be addressed.
Fish size problem.
The size problem. And so prior to 2007, there was a vote on the YRDFA board, and we were one vote short of complete consensus that there was not a problem on the Yukon River.
So one vote short of unanimous.
Yes.
Okay,
it was an executive, both of these were executive board votes, so I'd probably 12 people. Just guessing, 12 people, you know. And see, what we did is we found ourselves discussing the problem and arguing over it. And it was like, in order to do anything on the YRDFA board, there has to be complete consensus. We're a consensus board. And so it's not a majority rule board. So
it's not even consensus, it's unanimous.
Oh yeah, that's what I mean. Unanimous consensus. I was using the wrong meaning of the word consensus. Maybe. Anyway, complete consensus. And so I said, okay, well, we need to do that. So then right after the 2007 Board of Fish meeting, and this is part of history, so I write this down. This is, I think, on my website, or some of this is on my website. I have to update some of the more recent stuff. But after 2007, we had because the subject came up again and the runs were still declining, and we discussed whether or not we should reinstate the Fish Size Committee as active versus inactive. And so I, as chairman, I said, yes, that sounds like a good idea. Let's discuss that. But first, let's get a vote from the board whether or not they consider there to be a problem with fish size on the Yukon River. There was a second vote. It was one vote shy of complete consensus that there is not a problem on the Yukon River. This is fishermen from all the way from the mouth to the Canadian border on this board. This is supposed to be the representatives of all the areas. Now, by the way, I was the one person who voted that there was a problem.
In both of these votes, I thought you had everybody with you.
But No. One vote short of complete consensus that there was not a problem.
No problem. Oh, my God.
Okay. So, now, this is a little skewed because both of these votes, the Eagle representative was not there. We have problems all the time getting the Eagle representative there. Had that person been there, I would have, I'm sure, had a second vote. But the Eagle Fort Yukon person wasn't there. And then by the time, you know, the next, because they go by district, and those District 5 is a huge district, you know, it's just like there's just no other... you know, and Henry Wheel up in Rampart would be there, but Henry hasn't been actively fishing all that much lately, and Rampart is a net fisherman area, and really, you know, he didn't feel comfortable voting that there was a size problem. They run nets. They're catching 20-pound average fish. They don't see the size problem. People in Rampart don't really see this problem. It's not like a net fisherman in the rapids, like Frank Carruthers or something like that, who doesn't see, what for years didn't see a problem either, but all his fish wheel friends, he could look at their catch and see, you know, what they were catching. And so,
Because the fish wheel is doing this sort of random sample scoop.
Much more. There's probably a bias one way or the other, but it's small. The bias isn't, you know, it's not like massive, like with nets. Nets are, massive.
The little fish can go through and the big fish are caught.
Big fish are caught, and the females are even caught more, you know, the big-bellied females, and yeah. So anyway.
Stan, let me flip this.